Sophie.
Thank you. Thank you. My name's Sophie and I'm an addict.
Hi, Sophie.
Hi, and it's a great honour and privilege to share in NA, and I'm extremely nervous, but looking forward to 35 minutes' time when I get back to normal, because it's been, it just, the speaker meeting, you feel like you need to be a preacher and sort of, and I'm quite shy and gentle, and but it really is a privilege to have an amount of time to really reflect on my recovery. And the book was put here for the phone, but I thought, oh great, I hereby swear on the NA basic test to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And it just made me feel better. But what I was thinking, which is really funny, is I was absolutely terrified more than anything because it's being recorded. And I've done speaker meetings over probably, however, I don't know, decades. And if you probably listened to them all, you'd find lies and different versions of the story as time's gone on. And I mean, I know you would. And it's just awful. It's on the record. But I've been really thinking about my, at the moment, basically my mind, which lies to me and deludes me and changes the truth or sees its own version of the truth. And it's such an extraordinary thing, the more I go into it, really, through this process here, that I've been thinking about it a lot. And I'm doing a step four again. And if anyone's new, it's the thorough and fearless moral inventory, which terrified the living daylights out of me when I first came round the idea of doing it. And I find, like, I was listening to the other speakers share, and I find that whenever I'm on a step, I kind of live in it. So if I'm writing a step one, I feel the powerlessness and unmanageability and the pain. And if I'm writing a step two, I feel the craziness. And if I'm on step six and seven, I'm like, all my character defects are, like, sort of surrounding me all the time. And step 12, you could see, he's brilliant. had a spiritual awakening. And anyway, I'm on step four. And and sometimes I've sat here and gone, I don't know what all the fuss is about. It's so exciting. You find out so many interesting things about yourself, and it changes your life, and you have these relevant... And the one I'm doing at the moment is just not like that. I cry. I do it when I wake up, and I've cried. I wake up, I pray and meditate, and I do a bit of step four, and I've cried every morning this week. It's made me so sad. And I'm only on teenage. I'm only on, and then probably that will be the worst bit, to be honest. And it's a really, I've done lots of different versions, and this one literally asks me, did you do a driving test? What's your history with driving? You know, like, literally thorough. Like, and I can't tell you how much damage I've done driving, like, that I could have missed if they hadn't asked me that question. And it's, I'm just answering these questions about every aspect of being a teenager. And I just have a little cry, and I think what really has stayed with me is, I'd sort of jump around, is how, now that I'm 52, middle-aged, I've brought up teenagers, how, it's weird getting old, you're kind of uselessly wise. You're just like, oh, now I get it. And I go, it would have been helpful to know it then. But it's like, I just realised that everybody felt the same, probably. But I saw the world. It was so frightening to me. And I was so frightened of everyone else, and everyone had the key, and I just didn't. And I had no idea of how to express myself or communicate or do anything, and I was really, really frightened and self-obsessed. I just was frightened. Now I look back on it, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that at the time. And I hated both my parents are addicts and alcoholics, and more alcoholics, but pills and drink. And I hated addiction and swore I would never ever be like them. And aged 14, sort of under the floorboards in the gym at school, I drank Dubonnet. There was an advert for it on I don't even know how we got it. And I just felt this warmth sort of go through my body. And that was it. And it happened again, I remember, with Valium. Just peace for a moment. And until you have the peace, you don't know how disturbed you are. And there's no way you're ever going to not opt for the peace if you were as disturbed and frightened and anxious as I was. And also, I saw it as an identity, as, you know, there was a whole ready-made group of friends, you know, smoking behind the sheds, rolling joints, listening to this kind of music, going to gigs, whatever. There was a whole life and identity that could come with it and a place to belong. And I'm still really good friends with loads of people from that time because we're all in recovery now. One by one. Or have part, you know, there's the other side, which really... it's just heartbreaking. This is a really, really, really heartbreaking illness. And in the end, my mum hit her head in a pub and sort of got what looked like Parkinson's but wasn't, and became... she insists it started when she hit her head in this pub and became paralysed and died. And my dad died of liver failure. My uncle died of wet brain. And I was with all of them as they were dying, or... you know, it's awful, and loads of friends have gone, and I'm going through this. It's really strange. I really related. I thought I could never, ever, ever get clean once I was in the grip of my addiction. I just, when I first got clean, I just thought, however much I wanted it, it was, in spite of, I'm so frightened of myself. Now I realise I'm frightened of myself more than anything else, and I literally thought, I always say this, but literally like a syringe would maybe fall out of the sky. I couldn't, there was no way I could do it. But I was really remembering my first NA meeting when I was sitting here, and this woman was sharing about stealing from her mother, and I was like, oh my gosh, can't tell everybody you do that. What are you doing? You know, you're mad. But I remember it really, really, like, oh my God, you can be... it's the first time, like, the release, like that release of my first drinks and drugs that never really came again, those first highs that you keep trying to get and you never get back. First time I heard that honesty, I thought, oh, ooh, wouldn't that... that could be something not to carry. Because, of course, by the time I hit my rock bottom, I was carrying so much shame from using behaviours, really. And so that honesty really, really struck me. And also, I didn't get it the first time, but when someone said it was just for today, I was like, that is so clever. That is so clever. You know, we used to do these mad geographicals. I'm looking at you, maybe where we go somewhere, all of us addicts, to withdraw together. We'd go to Greece to come off what we considered our addictive drugs, with loads and loads of methadone, hash, pills, so much drugs. We'd go and we'd go on these kind of, I don't know, trying to get clean. And it was far more chaotic than our quiet life in Pimlico, sort of all on the sofa. It was really, and that happened quite a lot. And there was loads of times when I did it on my own as well. I'd go off and I'd try and stop using. I'd go and stay with straight friends who lived out of London because there wouldn't be anything there. And then I'd go downstairs in the middle of the night and drink one of their mother's box of wine and be vomiting all over the kitchen. It was just awful. And then I'd go through all the withdrawals, and then my feet would just take me straight back, and I was utterly powerless, and I couldn't stop. I had no control over my addiction, and so that just for today, I really got I could probably do it for a day, and I could do it a day at a time, and so I just think it's the most beautiful, perfect thing I ever heard, because a day at a time, I've been able to stay clean since I was 20, and I've told you my age, it's really decades now, and if I share nothing else, I suddenly realise I'm always embarrassed by my clean time, almost, because there's an expectation of kind of getting somewhere if you haven't used that long, but the truth is I'm an addict through and through on a daily basis, and I have to maintain this illness probably more today than I did then. And that's not a hopeless thing, because I've got a really beautiful life that I don't want to lose, and I've learned through experience that the more I put into it, the more I get out of it, and it's a sort of pleasure. There's a lot of pleasure in working this stuff, real pleasure. And today, as I say, I woke up, cried, wrote this bit of Step 4, cried, but then I open my emails and I've got a sponsee in Kenya, you know, writing step work to me, which is incredible. Then I went out for breakfast with four friends in this fellowship who we probably have breakfast every Friday. We've changed the date, but for years now, and we have a real laugh and cry often, but we sort of support each other, actually. We just share with each other every Friday, and it's lovely, and the meetings between the meetings. And then it sounds like I don't work. I do work sometimes, but today I don't know what happened. But I was just, then I did step 8 with someone, which was extraordinary. I've been thinking a lot about that, and in listening to them, I was really thinking about, because of this step work, I was thinking, I had this really, really lovely uncle as I was growing up, who was my dad's brother, and my dad and him kind of did everything together, and he didn't appear to be an alcoholic, although he did die of wet brain. He appeared to be the really together one, and he came to every school play, and when I was in treatment, he used to come, and he was a bachelor, and when I came out of treatment and I was scared to go and stay with my mum, I used to go and stay with him, and he really, really took care of me. And I just feel so bad, because I feel so bad because, well, when he was dying, there was no one else really to care for him. My brother had gone to live in Canada, and my sister was a young student. She's 20 years younger, and I had two small kids, and I sort of used to go to his house, get his mail, sort his stuff out, and then rush to the hospital and kind of sit there and think, well, have I visited him enough? And then kind of rush home, and I just feel so sad now, after all he did for me, that I wasn't more generous. And anyway, and the worst thing is, we haven't even put a headstone up for him. So today I decide, you know, I'm going to make him a really beautiful headstone. And so there's always more and more, you know, I've done some of my worst behaviour clean, because I haven't even got the excuse of drugs. So anyway, what else? So, and then someone came over at tea time and did their step 2, and it was extraordinary. She's so beautiful and so clever and has such an amazing higher power. And we had such an amazing conversation, because I've been really, this is going back to my crazy brain. Step 2 is about being restored to sanity, and a lot of my life, because my parents were alcoholics and it was crazy, I've often blamed them a lot for my behaviour, and I've really, and to just jump back, when I say I don't know what reality is, as I'm writing this step 4 again, I'm beginning to realise that actually probably there's a few handfuls of awful things that happened, but there's a whole, like, 15 years of living at home with probably nothing bad happening, or ever playing tennis against a wall, or watching, I don't know, the Roadrunner, or I don't know, eating. There's probably, and actually my mind really, really clings on to all things negative, bad, and all resentments, and keeps hold of them and uses it. Well, my addiction, I'm saying, like as a force for evil in the world. No, as a force to justify me and my bad behaviour and my using. And I was really, really thinking today when she was doing this step two and she was saying something, and I just thought, God, what if I'm really adverse to love? Like, I often go, I often say, oh, well, because my parents were drunk, they didn't give me much attention, and what I decided was that I was unlovable. But what if I don't know how to love always since second one? It's me that, what if I made up that thing about my mum, but my granny showed me love? You know, lots of, you know, there were lots of probably good moments in the day, and I just couldn't see or feel or hold on to love. And I think this is really important because I only lived with my mum till I was probably about 15 or 16. And then I've spent, whatever it is, do the maths, behaving in really strange, weird ways and saying it's her fault, but I haven't even seen her. She's been dead 12 years. And I think the reason I'm saying this is because I'm thinking a lot about peace of mind comes, the feeling I got from drugs came from, was peace. I sort of, well, or sleep, just, you know, just crash out. But I really, really, really seek the peace of mind, and you can't really have it if you're frightened and resentful. And I really, really want to, I feel like now I'm in my 50s, I'm living on borrowed time. Two really, really beautiful, long-term, clean men died last year. Paul and David, people who are just amazing, and their funerals were just a privilege and a testament to this recovery process, just the story, the generosity of these people, the goodness, the kindness, like there's sort of, that's what higher power is, just being, is when I was a kid, I went to Sunday school and there was a hymn, God is love, and I don't really know what a higher power is, but for me, it's the love and fellowship I feel in this room, and it's so I'm trying to work something out as I share, so it might sound a bit odd, but I'm just so paranoid and everyone's against me, and I'm always like wanting people to give me love, and where's the love? But it really is like, be the, you know, this program is sort of teaching me to be the love, and that's actually how you stay clean. I really got it. If you want what we have, we keep what we have by giving it away. And I often chase, I think, oh, if I have more money, or if I had this, or if I was successful and people looked up to me. But really, the happiest moments, there's quite a few people here, I volunteer somewhere, and the best laughs and the most kindness I've had is where I volunteer, with mostly people are relative newcomers, you know, and they have held me together over the last few years because I'm not cured. And because whenever I go through change, I'm lost again. And just as I think I'm really on top of my, you know, I go through these different stages in my recovery where I'm like, when I was 29, I'm like, oh, I've really got this now. And then I get pregnant and have a baby and I'm like, oh, it's so out of my depth. And I've got a whole new life of lessons of being a mother, of never being able to get to meetings, of being exhausted all the time. And then just as I'm really, and I love to complain, so, oh, it's so tiring being a mother, it's so, oh, you know, and, oh, they're so annoying. Well, they've left home now. And I am absolutely distraught. No one talks about it. I'm like, why doesn't everyone talk about this? This is trauma of the worst. You know, the Monday crying was about the kids leaving home because my friend Sheen came to stay with her little boy, Joel, and he sleeps in her bed and he cuddles her. And I was just like, I've had 22 years of living with my kids and little hands and people ribbing me and dogs and cats and children and family life and having to make breakfast and having to cook dinner and complain and complain and complain. And now I live totally on my own, suddenly. And there's a good side to it. But the grief, because they're the best thing, that they were just, it was just an amazing gift to have my kids. And just like everything here, I thought when I was 29 when I had my kids, for 9 years in my recovery, I thought, well, no one will love me, no one will want to have kids with me, I can't probably, God doesn't love, you know, I'm always negative, but I've had two kids, and then when I had them, well, God will probably take them away and kill them somehow, you know, but they're touch, they're, oh, I hate, just tempting fate, but, you know, right now, they're okay, and they're well, and they're happy, and they're thriving, and I'm so frightened and negative, and I think it's always going to happen to everyone else, and there's something about me that's specially different that needs to be punished. And it's just this brain, you know, it's so horrible. So of course I keep coming to the meetings, and in fact I've had times in my recovery where I've sort of almost gone mad without using. I was living in South America, and I had small kids, and I kind of wasn't getting to meetings, and I just wasn't doing the work, and I sort of thought, oh well, God understands, I've got kids, but this illness doesn't work like that. I just started going nuts, resentment, angry, blaming, bitter. Then it was very beautiful in Venezuela, so I'd be swimming, going, I think I'm never gonna. I think I'll just go under and not come up for air. And I just, at that point, I said to my husband, I think we need to get home. We need to get somewhere where I can speak the language and get some support. I'm really frightened. And I've gone, I've had that. I see this illness, it wants you dead through using drugs, but when you get clean, it'll do everything it can to almost mess up your life, you know. And so it sounds really negative, but here we have this kind of extraordinary daily reprieve. You can be having the most terrible time right now, and you can be doing the most awful things that make you feel shit or whatever, or not doing the things that make you feel good. And you can wake up the next day or start and just go, just for today, I'm going to get down on my knees and ask for help, and I'll call someone and I'll call a newcomer. You can absolutely change it. You can just change it like that. We're so lucky to have these skills. And as I go through life, I realise I'm luckier than loads of people. I've got such a strong support network. And if you don't have, like, as I say, my brother lives in Canada, my parents have died, I'm not married, I'm not in, you know, I don't, yeah, I've got all these amazing friends that sort of help me take these major life decisions, and which is incredible. So so the good thing about the kids leaving home is I've all sorts of things, like I can do things that I couldn't do when you have kids at home. So last year I went to live in the mountains quite a lot and did a project that I've always wanted to do, and finished it, and then friends said, oh, when can we see it? And so that made me had to show the project. And then it sort of, from that moment on, it got a life of its own. And all these really lovely kind of weird things have been happening to me as a result. Like two people have sort of taken a shine to it and kind of called me up and go, will you come and do this with it? Or, I'm being vague, but it's just that has been amazing and really exciting, and it's one of those things I've always wanted to do since I was 20, and I've finally done it, and that's amazing. And then the other thing is, I've always thought I really wanted to live in the countryside, and I heard a good one the other day, God is get outdoors, and a lot of my higher power has been in nature, actually. And so I've sold our family home, and I've bought a cottage in the middle of a field, and I'm there about 5 days a week, and it's really, really, really amazing. And this is just going to sound so naff, but I've got to share it because it's so exciting. If anyone saw those Disney films like Cinderella and Snow White with the girls in the woods with all the birds kind of helping them get dressed and pick flowers and everything. I swear, this week I got home and there was a little like blue tit on my doorstep, and I've got two dogs, and I thought the dogs will get it. It must be her. And I sort of picked it up and I was like, oh, blue tit. But I took it indoors to sort of, I don't know what, put it in a box to give it, help it get better or whatever, or maybe I'm going to have to kill it or whatever. And then it just flew around my house. It was perfectly fine, and it let me pick it up. And then the next day, two white doves were sort of dancing in front of me and sort of making love. Doves really do. They really do this amazing. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, nature. And the next day I was walking the dogs through this field, and someone called, a sponsee, and I thought, I'll lie down for this one. And I lay down and looked at the sky, and suddenly all these deer started. And I just thought, this is just like Disney. This is incredible. And so it really is amazing. And it's sort of, and friends come and stay, and you'd think that fellowship would be. You know, when I got clean, I love sharing this. I've got the Where to Find, and it's one side of A4 with hand typed. We didn't have computers. The list of the meetings, and we'd photocopy it. And there's 6 meetings a week, and now, you know, down there, there's really lovely meetings. Everyone thinks I'd be isolated. There's great meetings, great fellowship, and it's really, really lovely. But I'm working here 2 days a week, so I've got the best of both worlds. So that's really, really lovely. And everybody's got their own dreams and visions, and everyone's different. And the thing here is to make a meaningful life for yourselves. And the only requirement for your higher power is that it be loving. And so I often thought, my thinking was like, no, God needs me to suffer so that I can grow through pain, which is really quite perverse. But and I often am frightened of surrendering my will to a higher power in case it takes away the things that I want. But usually if the things that I want are pretty decent and okay, well, that, you know, my higher power is loving and actually wants it for me too. And my experience is that, you know, you do the footwork and you do have to hand over the results, but if you do the footwork for the things you love and you care about, usually then it gets, if it's meant to be, lots of good energy comes around it and really, really amazing things happen. And if you, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say this because I think I've often been really scared to surrender, and I keep control of everything, and it leads me down really blind alleys and to so much pain, this kind of trying to please people or trying to control things, and all those things, I haven't managed to hang on to them. But all these really, really lovely things that were beyond my wildest dreams, often conventions are called beyond your wildest dreams, but they really, I never imagined I'd have 2 kids. I'd never imagined I was sort of like in my little Disney film. But having said that, if you think I'm stayed, I was in the Kalahari Desert in December, living with the Bushmen, who dug me little beds and put grass down so that it was soft, and an old man and a young man slept either side of me to protect me from scorpions. Like, I really, like, it's really what, and I decided to do this MA in anthropology, which is like, in early recovery, I read loads and loads of self-help books. But then as I've gone along, I was trying to understand us as systems. Like, if you go into the prison system, you're like, this doesn't work. If you go into the NHS, it doesn't. Like, we've got all these systems, and I was like, not accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can. Why? What are these things? Why don't they work? I want to understand. I want to be more active. I want to be more member of my society. And I learned that here through doing service here. And so I'd done this anthropology degree, and the day I was handing it in, I was like, oh, we're going to be in trouble now. This has been a really good distraction from the kids leaving home. You know, shit, tomorrow you're going to wake up and you've got no masters, got no kids, you've got no boyfriend, you're just you. And I'm more frightened of myself than anything in the world, right? And I just thought, oh, it's going to be... I was like, oh, God. And my phone went, bing, as it does. And I literally was going, what am I going to go and do next? And it went, bing, and it went, hello, Sophie. It is a long time since we have heard from you. We are electing a new spiritual head in the desert. It would be good if you came. From the Bushmen. Like, who gets emails like that? I certainly don't. I was like, who? Okay. I'll do it. And I thought that I was on God's will. I'm like, oh my God, you know, I'm really meant to do this. And actually it was one of the hardest and most horrific things I've ever done. And I still haven't shared how traumatic it was, because it's really heavy post-colonial. It was just so distressing. And the people I was... I can't even want to share about that. I've got to wind up in 2 minutes. So you have all these... But it was really... That's the thing about this. Everything's like... You think you're going to come into recovery and give up drugs, but you end up going on this extraordinary journey where you do a day at a time, stay clean. And if you let it happen to you, I can't say what's going to happen to anyone else, but you've got to let it happen to you. And sometimes that's it. I'm so busy chasing things that I stop really prioritizing this. But as I said, today mostly was about recovery, and you'd think that my whole life's recovery, but it's not. I got home just before the sponsee arrived, and I thought, if you don't make these 6 calls now in 15 minutes, you're going to really feel bad because it's Friday and you really should have done this. And I just went bang, 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 and I got as much... Sometimes it takes me 2 weeks to do those 6 calls. You know what I mean? If you actually... You think that doing the NA footwork is going to take away time from doing this, that, or the other. But actually, the more you do this, the more relaxed you are, the more open you are, the more things can come to you, the more ideas. You know, you can try and sort out a problem in your head and drive yourself mad. If you can sit down and pray, and somehow praying will open a tiny... I don't know how praying works, but open a little space, and then the idea can just come in. And I suppose I'm selling this to myself as much as to anyone else, but what I'm saying is really, really, if you can surrender to this program, and it's really easy, it's like do the steps, reach out, call people, do service. People here know from me, I've done prison service, and it's led me on this extraordinary journey, prison service, like an amazing, amazing journey to places I'd never believe. It is my time. I don't know if I've carried the message enough about how it works, but it does. But you've got to let it work. And I think I was lucky. I wish I'd almost shared, because now that I'm an old timer, I sort of realise I'm getting to be an old timer. But we used to sort of have so few members that we would drive 3 hours to a meeting. We didn't have mobile phones. You'd walk in the middle of the night with a 10p and call your sponsor. You'd go to any lengths. You'd drive to a mental... You were so desperate for people to talk to that you'd go to a hospital and go, have you got any addicts locked up? You would. I'd go, help me stay clean. You were really... And people in London just take it for granted. And I do this all the time, so I'm saying this for myself. But if my sponsor, she's still my sponsor today, I was coming to meetings really ill, 20, with a Doberman pincher, with a really bad habit, having seizures in the meetings, could not stop using, pulling out my hair as a kind of neurotic playtime habit. And this woman went... She just came up to me and went, I think we're going to try and get you somewhere safe and just get you away. And it isn't the rooms, and I always feel bad about that, but she, you know, this woman bothered that day to come up and talk to me after the meeting rather than go and talk to a handsome man or her best friend, or she bothered. And it's, if she hadn't have done that, I didn't know how to ask for help. I was in prison in Greece going to court. It never occurred to me to phone someone in England and go, I'm in a foreign country, aged 18, going to court. I need a lawyer. I just went. And the police felt so sorry for me that I was so on my own, and other long stories which are in other shares, that the police came and helped me protect myself in court. Do you know what I'm saying? So we, you know, it's good to end on that, is we need to sort of help each other out, and the old timers as well need help and love, and we all just need, you know, and that's what I've got here. It's a really amazing fellowship if you let it. It is really trying to let people in, isn't it, and learn about relationships. Someone said it's a disease of non-relation, and it's about trying to relate, and, you know, and instead of going, God out there, be God. I am ending on this. God, you know, God can only be kind if, there's no flash of lightning going to be kind to you. I have to be kind to you. Do you know what I mean? So, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.